Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, after winning the New Hampshire primary, Donald Trump sharpens his attacks on Nikki Haley as her campaign looks ahead to her home state of South Carolina.
The United States strikes back against militants attacking American interests in the Middle East, but the attacks keep coming. A look at the fine line the Biden administration is walking to avoid a regional war.
We don't want to see the conflict escalate. We don't want to see some broader war. We're not looking for a war or a conflict with anybody.
And alcohol-related deaths surge in Colorado and other Western states with a higher mortality rate than the opioid crisis. Welcome to the NewsHour. Former President Donald Trump's second primary victory last night in New Hampshire makes it more likely that this year's race for president will be a rematch of 2020.
But while Mr. Trump and President Biden are already setting their sights on each other, former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley is reminding Republican voters she's still in the fight. We're joined now by Democratic strategist Michael Meehan, a former longtime aide to Democratic members of Congress, and Republican strategist Kevin Madden, who advised Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. It's great to have you both here. So Donald Trump is now the first non-incumbent Republican to win both the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary. Here's a bit of what the former president had to say last night in his victory speech.
We are going to win this. The reason we have support is because they are so bad at what they're doing and so evil, and they're destroying our country.
So he says we're going to win this, but looking at the voter surveys, the Associated Press voter surveys from last night, Kevin, 21% of Republicans who cast ballots in the New Hampshire primary said they'd be so dissatisfied with Donald Trump as a general election candidate that they wouldn't even vote for him. And 15% of Republicans who participated in the Iowa caucuses said the same thing. How does Donald Trump unify the party and move ahead to a general election with those kind of numbers?
Well, you're right. I think it's indicative of some of the tension in his message. I think, you know, base Republican voters right now, what really energizes them is Donald Trump being this fighter who can take on the perceived excesses of the left and fight against Joe Biden, everything that he's done wrong and where the way he's took the country in the wrong direction. But at the same time, one of the big challenges he has is that a lot of more moderate, pragmatic voters, swing voters, they are very upset with the idea that he is constantly relitigating the 2020 election, and he is constantly looking backward. So the path forward, the way to unify the party and really win over swing voters if he's going to win the general election in November, has to be focused on a more future-oriented message about the issues that people care about. Now, he's going to have his own way of talking about those issues, but the economy, immigration, national security, foreign policy, problems that we have or challenges that we have around the globe, really focus on those and where he wants to take the country in the future.
The other big story of the night was President Biden got more votes as a write-in candidate who didn't even compete in New Hampshire than former President Barack Obama did back in 2012 when he did contest that primary in New Hampshire. How does the Biden campaign build on that momentum moving forward, especially with this new shakeup in the leadership of their campaign?
Well, I think you saw a great organization by the New Hampshire Democrats, right? Senator Sheen, Senator Hassan, you know, put a big effort into making sure that Joe Biden finished out on top. And that's the kind of things that that's going to help you win a close election. We have seen since Trump stacked the court and overturned abortion rights for women all across this country that there's been about a 10 or 11% more performance on election day for Democrats in competitive races. And so I think last night was a big win for Joe Biden. He wasn't even on the ballot. He beat Barack Obama, who walked across water when he was running for re-election. So he's constantly undercounted, but the organization's is worth a couple of points. And in a couple point race, like he beat Trump last time, that's a very important thing.
Nikki Haley faces a lot of questions about the viability of her campaign since there's little evidence that she has major support in the primaries and the caucuses that await her campaign. Realistically, is there anything that she can do to boost her standing between now and then?
Well, look, I think the biggest challenge that she's going to have is just her own campaign and her donors. They right now are funding the building of an infrastructure and a campaign that has lost double digit in the first two contests. And she's going to have to present the plan to the donors, much like a business plan, which is here's the way going forward, and here's where I start offering details about where you win and how you take that momentum into the bigger part of the calendar, where you have 16 contests all the way up until, I think it's March 19th, right? Mm-hmm. March 5th and then March 19th. So she really has to make a case that she can win somewhere there, because otherwise, it's really hard to make the case to keep the resources going. And in places like Florida, where this campaign, you know, if it's going to continue on, it's going to have to compete. It's like $3 million a week to compete there. So you really do have to consolidate your support amongst your donors. If you're going to get the volunteer and voter enthusiasm, if you're going to get the volunteer and voter enthusiasm that you're going to need to win somewhere.
President Biden, who walked the picket lines last year with striking auto workers, today picked up the endorsement of the United Auto Workers Union. Here's some of what he told that group today.
The days of working people being dealt out of the deal are over in this country as long as I'm president. Working people are going to get their fair share. You've earned it. You fought for it. And you deserve it.
So how will that endorsement, and more importantly, his message of economic populism, how will that boost his effort to reach out to voters in Michigan and working class Americans who really have comprised that blue wall that Democrats need to keep in order to win the White House?
Yeah. So the stock market's all-time high, unemployment's at a 50-year low, and what Joe Biden did today was tell people that you're going to be cut in on this deal, too. Keep me in office, and we're going to make sure that the prosperity that people at the top are seeing and all across the country, they're going to see it when you go to work every day and take a shower when you come home at night. Those are the kind of voters that Joe Biden resonates with. That's how he won the first time. That's how he's going to win again.
I want to play for you, Kevin, a bit of what Nikki Haley said last night and point our focus to something in particular.
Most Americans do not want a rematch between Biden and Trump. No! The first party to retire its 80-year-old candidate is going to be the party that wins this election.
So the polling actually bears out the first part of what she said, is that, you know, most Americans aren't thrilled about the prospects of a Trump-Biden rematch. And here we are facing the longest general election in history. Which campaign is helped by that? Which campaign is hurt by that?
By the length of the campaign.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the fact that Joe Biden is... the tough thing about campaigns is they're grueling not only emotionally, but they're grueling and they're taxing physically. And I think Joe Biden, one of the criticisms that many voters have is that he doesn't seem like he's up to the job and up to the task. And so I think the more of this campaign drags on and the more intense it gets, and the travel and the tone and tenor that Trump is going to set, where he's going to be very aggressive during this campaign, I think it works to Trump's advantage. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of voters right now see when they worry about the prospects of Joe Biden inside the Democratic coalition.
And yet the Biden campaign and the White House are trying to focus on issues. The White House said today that they're inviting Kate Cox, that's the Texas woman at the center of that high-profile abortion case. She will be the guest of First Lady Jill Biden at the State of the Union address.
Yeah, I think the White House is doing right on that, because women across this country will not tell a pollster that I'm not going to vote for somebody once their rights have been taken away. And we have seen when they actually go and vote, they go and vote for the Democrat, they go and vote for Joe Biden. Because Donald Trump doesn't talk about this anymore, but he talked for the first half of this campaign about the three justices he put on that overturned Roe v. Wade. He's not talking about that because he's right. He should be scared, because the silent majority of those women have come out and have elected Democrats in really red states and really red places in the last 2.5 years since the ruling came down.
Michael Meehan, Kevin Madden, thank you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nikki Haley faces an uphill climb in the next state on the primary map, South Carolina, where she was raised and served as governor. The state was also key to President Biden's victory in the 2020 primary, and now could serve as a signal on his standing with black voters nationwide. To discuss what to watch in the Palmetto State, I'm joined now by South Carolina Public Radio's Thalisha Eady. Thalisha, it's great to see you. Let's start with the Republican race in South Carolina. Nikki Haley's home state, she's a former governor. Will Republican primary voters choose her over former President Trump?
You know, Amna, when I think about Nikki Haley, I refer to it as the peculiar case of Nikki Haley. So we have this Native daughter, we have this former governor who was in position and made the call to remove the Confederate flag from the State House domes. Really big deal. A lot of people and activists were trying to get that done. Seemed like checks all the way down the board, but one consistent thing that kind of overshadows those things is when I talk with folks on both sides of the political spectrum is the criticism that they have on Nikki Haley or about her is that they don't know who she is. That's what we're hearing from people. Just this morning, spoke with a mom, entrepreneur, mom of three. She says she is leaning heavily towards voting for Trump, and that's because he is firm in who he says he is and what he believes in and his record. When I asked her about her opinions on the former governor, she uses the term chameleon, and she says she feels as though that the former governor is just becoming a better politician. So even though this is Nikki's home state, and I know that Haley is looking to have home state advantage, for the Republicans here, it almost seems as though that this is Donald Trump's home state. He's made lots of campaign visits and rallies here before, and just this past week, we saw him flanked on stage with many members of our leadership here in South Carolina. It's a strange situation. It seems like a strange situation, but I think that's what our former governor will have to contend with as we lead up to our primary.
Meanwhile, as you know, on the Democratic side, South Carolina holds real significance for President Biden. Black voters in particular back in 2020 really saved and resurrected his campaign. 4 years later, are they willing to show up and motivated enough to show up and support him in the same way?
You know, a few weeks ago, when talking with a Democratic member who's working deeply in the party, the same messaging was there. They're celebrating the fact that they have this loyal block of African-American voters, and particularly female African-American voters, and they're very loyal that they will get out and get the word out and knock on doors. But also in the conversation and also what they're pushing is that there is work to do. So we have younger voters in who's now in the party, and they're trying to stress as they get out the vote, they're trying to stress that we understand that you may feel a little disenfranchised, if you will, or that your vote may not always count, or that you're not always at the forefront. But the term that this individual used was, we need you to have muscle memory. We need you to remember what party works for you. And so there are campaign events and rallying events happening this weekend, and that's the messaging. They're trying to target their younger voters, and they're trying to remind people that we are the party that's working for you. This person actually called it a survival vote for African Americans. So many of the issues that plague so many of the African American communities here in South Carolina, the party wants those voters to remember that, you know, we're in for the hard work. It's going to take hard work. It's not going to happen overnight, but have that muscle memory, remember who we are, and stick with us. That's what I'm hearing from them.
Talisha, the South Carolina electorate, just broadly, very different to the electorate we saw in New Hampshire and in Iowa. Who makes the difference in South Carolina, and what are the issues that are on the tops of their minds right now?
You know, the mom that I spoke to this morning, when I asked her why she's leaning towards former President Trump, and she said, you know, she's really pleased with his record. And I asked her in particular, what about his record? And top of her mind, immigration. And she said that's a really key issue for her. What I'm hearing a lot from people on the Republican side, what matters to them, the tie that binds them, faith, value, and being able to determine where a person stands. And so she used the term, I like it when people, their message lines up with my faith values, what I read in the scripture. On the Democrat side, a lot what I'm hearing about is that survival vote. African Americans are plagued with a lot of issues in different parts of our state, and so they want to make sure that they are heard. And so again, that large loyal voting bloc for Democrats, the African Americans and women who are really taking the lead and pushing the party forward, I think those two groups are the ones that would need to be watched and during this time, during this cycle.
That is South Carolina Public Radio's Talisha Eady joining us tonight. Talisha, thank you so much. Great to see you.
Thank you.
In the day's other headlines, Israeli forces and Hamas militants battled outside the main hospital in Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city. That left thousands of Palestinian patients and refugees trapped in the area. Thousands more fled to Rafah along the Egyptian border. They are joining 1.5 million displaced Gazans already crammed into encampments there.
I swear there is no safe place. We are scared for our children. We didn't sleep all night with rain and bombing ongoing above us. I set up the tent using nylon. This is the harshest period of winter.
Back in Khan Yunis, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees reported that an Israeli tank round killed 9 people and wounded 75 at a UN training center. Israeli officials have said Hamas fighters operate around UN sites and other civilian structures. Moscow is accusing Ukrainian forces of shooting down a Russian military transport plane today, killing all 74 people on board. The Russians say the plane went down in the Belgorod region as it was flying 65 Ukrainians to a prisoner swap at the border. Amateur video showed the plane bursting into flames as it fell from the sky and plummeted to the ground. Ukrainian officials did not immediately confirm or deny the claim. A state trooper in Minnesota was charged with second-degree murder today in the death of a black motorist. Body camera video showed Ryan Londrigan approaching Ricky Cobb's car during a traffic stop in Minneapolis last summer. State officials say Londrigan opened fire when the vehicle started to move. The Minneapolis area has had a series of fatal police encounters, including the murder of George Floyd in 2020. Ohio will be the 23rd state to ban gender-affirming care for those under the age of 18. Republican lawmakers enacted that today over GOP Governor Mike DeWine's veto. He issued a ban by executive order, but argued that enshrining it into law was overreach. The measure also bars transgender athletes from girls and women's sports teams in public schools and colleges. Johnson & Johnson agreed today to pay $150 million to Washington State in an opioid settlement. Opioid deaths in the state had more than doubled to more than 2,000 from 2019 to 2022. Nationwide, drug companies and others have reached $50 billion in opioid settlements in recent years. Across Europe, farmers protested from France to Poland over sliding incomes and regulation. Demonstrators say rising costs and cheap imports are putting unfair pressure on the industry. In France, they put up roadblocks and filled streets with tractors. Some took their case against higher costs and cheap imports to the EU Parliament in Brussels.
The message is, stop us from being caught in the middle. They impose more and more draconian standards on us, but on the other hand, our produce isn't protected. We need to be cleaner and cleaner, which costs us more and more, but we're in a global market, so the cheapest wins.
Among other things, the farmers cited special wartime rules that let Ukraine ship more produce to the rest of Europe. In economic news, China's central bank announced it's reducing the amount of cash that banks have to hold as reserves. The goal is to free more money for lending and in turn boost the country's struggling post-COVID economy. It's the latest in a series of moves aimed at stabilizing China's markets and shoring up confidence in the economic outlook. And on Wall Street, stocks had a mixed day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 99 points to close at 37,806. The Nasdaq rose 56 points and the S&P 500 added 4. And next month, comedian Jon Stewart will return to The Daily Show as host and executive producer, but only hosting on Monday nights and through the election. Stewart led the satirical program for 16 years before leaving in 2015. The Daily Show has not had a permanent host in more than a year. Still to come on the NewsHour, U.S. attacks on Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen raise fears of a wider regional war. A new book documents the racism of a Jim Crow-era mental health facility. The Oscars spark controversy by snubbing Barbie for Best Actress and Director, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour. From WETA Studios in Washington and in the West, from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The war in Gaza has killed more than 25,000 Palestinians. That's according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Our colleagues at Independent Television News have sent us evidence of one more death, an apparently unarmed man walking with a group of men under a white flag with their hands up. ITN's cameraman in Gaza documented the killing. The reporter is John Irvine in Israel. And to caution, this story includes images of violence.
This is the edge of the supposedly safe area called Al-Mawasi that the Israelis have been encouraging Gazan civilians to flee to. These makeshift homes have been vacated because the war is getting closer. The billowing smoke was evidence of the new Israeli offensive in Khan Yunus that has been forcing more families to evacuate and seek safety elsewhere.
No place safety in Gaza. Everywhere you are going, you will find the Israeli army. They are shoot us at home, any building, in the street, everywhere you are. They will give you a chance, sometimes just for 5 minutes, sometimes do not give you any chance to take your clothes, to take your children, to take your family, and to get out of the building. This is our life in Gaza. It's very difficult.
These pictures were filmed by a cameraman working for ITV News in Gaza. As he moved forwards towards the combat zone, he noticed this group of men doing their utmost to appear non-threatening, trying to proceed with care. They wanted to reach two other family members and get them out of harm's way.
I have my mother and brother in there, with around 50 or 70 displaced people in another house. The Israelis came to us and told us to evacuate, but they didn't let my brother out. We want to go and try to get them, God willing.
The interview complete, our cameraman walked away. And then this happened. The interviewee had been shot and fatally wounded. You can see them place their flag on his chest. As he was carried away, the white flag was turning red. Carry him, they've killed him, yells this youth. Then suddenly, more gunfire. They scream at a child, telling him to find cover. By this stage, the man's wife, his widow, has heard what happened. And as she rushes to the scene, she meets the party carrying away the body on a makeshift stretcher. When they're satisfied they're a safe distance away, they stop. And the mourning starts.
We asked the Israel Defense Forces to respond to the story today. A spokesman said, quote, "We're not aware of the event and it's still under examination." An Israeli defense official later told PBS NewsHour that an Israeli analysis of the audio found that two weapons fired shots. They say one was an automatic that fired three bullets, and the rate of fire does not correspond to any rifle used by the Israeli military. The official added they are investigating further.
One of the U.S. priorities since the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack has been preventing violence from expanding across the region. But overnight, the U.S. launched strikes at Iranian-backed groups in both Iraq and Yemen following attacks by those groups. And once again today, Houthi rebels fired missiles at multiple American ships. Nick Schifrin looks at the widening U.S. military campaign and the threat posed by Iran.
Just after midnight in Iraq, U.S. strikes targeted an Iranian-backed militia. 2 hours later in Yemen, the U.S. military targeted Iranian-backed Houthi rebels. strikes in two different Middle Eastern countries against two different Iranian-supported groups designed, in the words of National Security Council spokesman John Kirby, to prevent wider war.
We don't want to see the conflict escalate. We don't want to see some broader war. We're not looking for a war or a conflict with anybody. We're actually trying to de-escalate.
Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps has long supported what Iran calls an axis of resistance to conduct forward defense against its enemies. In Iraq, that includes Hatayb Hezbollah, a Shia paramilitary group that the U.S. labels terrorists, but is also part of the Iraqi military that helped defeat ISIS. Last weekend, the U.S. military says the group fired rockets and ballistic missiles at this U.S. military base, Al-Assad, causing, quote, a number of American injuries. The U.S. military says last night's U.S. strikes targeted Hatayb Hezbollah's headquarters, storage, and training sites.
We're not going to hesitate to take necessary action to protect our troops and our facilities, and we'll stay vigilant going forward.
But Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani today called the strikes, quote, irresponsible escalation, after reiterating a threat to push U.S. troops out of Iraq.
After the repercussions and attacks on the Iraqi security headquarters, we have the right to start this dialogue immediately in order to reach an agreement on arranging a timetable for the end of the mission of international advisors.
In Yemen, the U.S. says Iran provides the Houthis intelligence, money, and the advanced weapons that allow the group to target international shipping. 30% of global container traffic sails through the Suez Canal via the Red Sea. Dozens of Houthi attacks have forced many ships to reroute around Africa, driving up consumer prices and causing supply chain delays. The shipping company Maersk says today's Houthi attacks targeted two American ships, the Maersk Detroit and the Maersk Chesapeake, as they carried cargo for the U.S. Department of Defense. Because of that cargo, they were being escorted by U.S. Navy ships that shot down two Houthi missiles. To stop the missiles, the U.S. hopes Beijing pressures Iran to rein in the Houthis. It's not clear if Beijing's willing to help, but publicly today urged restraint.
China calls for a halt to the harassment of civilian ships and urges relevant parties to refrain from aggravating tensions in the Red Sea.
The U.S. and U.K. have launched nearly 10 rounds of strikes on the Houthis and vow to keep going, said President Biden on Thursday.
When you say working, are they stopping the Houthis? No. Are they going to continue? Yes.
Tonight, a Houthi spokesman took credit for today's attacks on American ships and vowed the attacks would continue. To discuss tensions in the region and the U.S. response so far, we get two views. Michael Duran was a senior director on the George W. Bush National Security Council staff and now directs the Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East at the Hudson Institute, a Washington think tank. And Ali Vaez was a senior political affairs officer at the United Nations and is now the Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group, which describes itself as working to prevent conflict around the world. Thanks very much. Welcome to both of you. Michael Duran, let me start with you. What is your assessment so far on U.S. strikes on Houthis in Yemen and U.S. strikes in Iraq on Iranian-backed groups? Do you believe that the strikes have been effective?
They're not going to do the job. And the president basically just admitted that. And Maersk has also said at the World Economic Forum that this is going to go on for months. That is shipping through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal will be disrupted for months. So clearly it's not working. And if this is Operation Prosperity Guardian, we're not guarding it.
Ali Vaez, let me ask you the same question. What's your assessment so far of the U.S. strikes in both Yemen and Iraq?
Well, I agree that they're not working, but because we're addressing the symptoms here and not the proximate cause, which is the war in Gaza, look, the reality is that the Houthis have been engaged in a war with the Saudi-led coalition for many years, and they've been targeted with the same U.S. weapons that we're now using against them for multiple years, and they have never been deterred. They're simply undeterrable, they're capable, they're determined, they're zealots, and they have very little to lose. And in fact, they have been gaining in popularity at home as a result of this and in stature internationally. And we've had the same experience in Iraq also for many years. Using the military tool, Nick, is not the solution here. It is an option for sure, but it's not a solution.
Michael Duran, are the Houthis undeterrable, as Ali Vaez just said, and is the military solution not the solution?
No, they're human beings, so they're deterrable. They're also being aided by the Iranians, and the Iranians are deterrable. You know, a little reported fact is that the Houthis, for the first time ever in the world, used an anti-ship ballistic missile. So they debuted it in combat. The Houthis, who don't have a serious defense industrial base, they're able to do this because the Iranians are there providing them with this weaponry. The IRGC general in Sana'a, who's responsible for this, is Abdulreza Shahlai, who is a who's on our terrorist list because he killed Americans in Iraq. He's the guy who orchestrated the attempt to kill Adel al-Jubeir, the Saudi ambassador here in 2011. So we have a guy who has a history of killing Americans, of organizing attacks on American soil. He's delivering these weapons to the Houthis. If we held him responsible, we could deter them.
Ali Vaez, what about that? Holding Iranian officials in Yemen responsible, and indeed the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps itself responsible?
Look, Nick, again, there is a long track record to look at here. You remember when the U.S. killed General Soleimani in 2020 in Baghdad, we were told that deterrence is restored and now Iran would no longer be able to project power in the region. In the past few weeks, Israel has taken out multiple Iranian commanders in Syria, as well as a Hamas commander in Beirut. The U.S. has taken out a Shia militia commander in Baghdad. And it has been bombing the Houthis now at least seven times. So, again, there's a long track record to look at here. We had, at certain point, 150,000 troops on both sides of Iran's borders in Iraq and Afghanistan, and yet we were not able to deter them. Again, the military option is not a solution to every issue we have in that region. Whereas if you look at last year, for instance, Iran and the U.S. were engaged in quiet diplomacy that led to a de-escalatory understanding between them, which resulted in the longest period in which we had no attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria. Now, in the course of the past 3.5 months since the war in Gaza started, we have had more than 150 attacks on U.S. forces. And so the correlation is very simple to understand, I think.
Michael Duran, take on that last point, that it is diplomacy, not military action, that creates de-escalation.
Here's a conversation that has never taken place in Tehran, where the IRGC says, let's orchestrate attacks against America and its allies all around the region. And the supreme leader says, you know what? There is no military option. It just doesn't work. We should de-escalate. They're the ones who escalated after October 7th. They defined the conflict in Gaza as a contest between Iran and its resistance axis and the United States. The United States has tried to de-escalate by responding and saying, this is a conflict between Israel and Hamas only. They have not reciprocated. I think we need to draw the conclusion. They're escalating. The only way to make them de-escalate is to take things from them that they hold dear.
Ali Vaez, respond to that fundamental point that Michael Duran just said, that the tension is not about as you said, or the source of the tension is not about the war in Gaza, but this is really about Iran and its proxies versus the United States.
Well, look, again, we had a period right before the war in Gaza that we had no attacks on U.S. forces in the region. And let me once again say that the reality here is that we have a long track record of testing both of these propositions, diplomacy and military force. And I remind your viewers that we went into Afghanistan and we spent trillions of dollars and 20 years of war to replace the Taliban with the Taliban. So we have to understand that there are limits to the use of military force. I'm not saying that these are good people and we should not do anything, but I'm saying use of force is not useful unless and until we have a realistic and achievable diplomatic solution and an end game here, and I'm not seeing any of that. Both Iran and the United States are acting as arsonists and firefighters at the same time. I believe neither of them has an interest in expansion of the war, but unfortunately, there's no diplomacy here to try to actually bring this to an end.
We've only got about 45 seconds left, so just in the time we have left, just briefly, Michael Duran, let's just talk about Iraq quickly. Could these strikes lead to the expulsion of U.S. troops from Iraq?
It's certainly possible, but everyone in the region is watching this, and they're watching to see if the United States is going to protect itself and protect its allies. The United States is under direct attack by proxies of Iran that are under the command and control of Iran. If we do not defend ourselves and we don't defend our allies, then everyone in the region is going to draw the conclusion that we're not going to defend them. We won't defend ourselves. We certainly won't defend them. And they will hedge toward Iran and toward China. One of the most perverse things we hear is that the United States is asking China, our global rival, to help us with Iran. How is that possibly going to work?
Ali Vaez, quickly, should the U.S. be concerned that it will lose its presence in Iraq?
It is quite possible, although I have to say it seems that the Iraqi government itself does want the U.S. to remain in Iraq so that we don't see another reemergence of ISIS or another radical group. So yeah. That is working in our favor. But as long as the tensions in the region are continuing, the risk of U.S. Fatalities, I think, remains pretty high.
Ali Vaez, Michael Duran, thanks very much to you both.
Thank you.
Alcohol is one of the leading causes of preventable deaths in the U.S. Every year, more people die of alcohol-related causes than drug overdoses. But problems with alcohol often go overlooked. William Brangham looks at how this is affecting the western part of the country, and one state in particular.
While alcohol is problematic everywhere, Colorado has one of the highest rates of alcohol-related deaths in the country. Drinking deaths in the state spiked 60% between 2018 and 2021. In 2022, more than 1,500 people in the state died from excessive drinking, a slight decline from earlier, but that is still 50% above pre-pandemic levels. When you also take into account deaths from chronic long-term conditions related to alcohol, the death toll doubles, a number that far exceeds the deaths from opioids. But as the Denver Post reported in a new four-part series, alcohol has not been treated with the same urgency as opioids. That series is called Colorado's Quiet Killer, and reporter Meg Wingutter joins me now. Meg, thank you so much for being here. Your series is titled The Quiet Killer. Why do you refer to it as quiet?
It's quiet in the sense that it hasn't generated much attention. You know, we hear about the number of people who are dying of opioids, which of course is a massive killer that we need to pay attention to. But there's not really the awareness that alcohol can also be deadly. When I was writing this series and interviewing people, other than people who specifically study alcohol, there was just not really this awareness that the death toll could be anything comparable because, well, I mean, it's not something people talk about very much. Many people would really rather not admit if excessive drinking was what killed their loved one. So we just don't have the conversation.
When we talk about categorizing deaths from alcohol, can you break those down for us? Are we talking about accidents where people are intoxicated? Is this chronic conditions? What are these deaths?
I'm glad you asked that because when I was interviewing people, often what would come up is they would assume that this was a lot of people dying in crashes or young people drinking themselves to death in one night. But what it is mostly is longer term conditions, a lot of liver disease, some cancers, some heart conditions, deaths by suicide where people were intoxicated at the time, which makes you more impulsive, more likely to follow through in suicide if you were having those thoughts. So it does look different than what people expect. Accidents are a problem, but they're not the biggest source of the problem.
Are there things that public health experts told you might help for the state to do to help bring these deaths down?
Well, there's no one magic thing that if we do this, it will make a huge impact on deaths. But there are a lot of small things that can nudge people. When alcohol taxes go up, people tend to somewhat reduce their consumption. When alcohol is not as convenient, people also will tend to drink a little bit less. There are cultural things, you know, trying to give people alternatives and kind of normalize events where drinking isn't at the center of it. Now, none of those is going to completely fix the problem, but they each kind of give people a nudge toward reducing their consumption, which over time adds up to fewer people developing these chronic conditions.
I mean, alcohol, as your reporting shows, is so ingrained in our culture, even though we are in the middle of dry January. I mean, it's kind of notable that we even have a month where we try to drink less as a culture. Were you surprised overall by the things that you found in your series?
Yes, I had actually just kind of stumbled across these numbers on alcohol-related deaths and looked at those, and that seemed high, compared it to the overdoses. But as I started talking to people more about the number of conditions that it's involved in, it makes sense. The odds an average drinker will die from alcohol are much lower than the odds an average illicit fentanyl user will die from the substance they're using. But so many people drink that it then adds up to this very large toll. And it is uncomfortable to talk about in a way that illicit drugs are not, because so many of us enjoy having a drink and don't necessarily want to hear that it could be a problem.
All right. That is Meg Wingutter of the Denver Post. Thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you for having me.
Crownsville State Hospital in Maryland was one of the last segregated mental asylums in the country, and it operated for some 93 years. Thousands of black patients came through over the years, and many of them died there. NBC News correspondent Antonia Hilton began looking into the facility a decade ago during her first year of college. I spoke with her recently about her findings, which she details in a new book, Madness, Race and Insanity in a Jim Crow Asylum. And I asked her why she wanted to tell this story.
It was my freshman year, and I stumbled into a course about the history of psychiatry. And I became obsessed. On the one hand, it was an academic obsession, a passion for the history of mental health. But there was also a personal aching and longing, I think, because I come from a very big, tight-knit family. I'm one of seven kids. But the one topic that always seemed off limits when I was growing up was mental trauma and mental illness. And that's because I came from a family with a long history of dealing with those issues, and loved ones, relatives who had spent time in institutions not unlike Crownsville. And so when I finally was out on my own as a young adult, it was my moment to explore, to try to find myself, my family, a bit of my history reflected somewhere. And I stumbled upon a footnote about Crownsville Hospital. And I didn't know then what this would become, but I knew that I had found something really special and really important, a key piece of black history, of the history of psychiatry, but really it's an American story, a story that I think implicates all of us.
Tell me about what you uncovered, though, because you go on, as you mentioned, a decade-long journey uncovering documents, talking to people who work there, family members of folks who were at Crownsville as well. You basically document the story of a chronically underfunded, perpetually short-staffed facility surrounded by hostile neighbors, subject to the same overt and violent racism as many other institutions and resources for black people at the time. What was the impact of that on the people who were there?
Crownsville is this complicated institution that comes to reflect all of these evolving battles in our country. In its early years, founded in 1911, and one of the things that was most shocking to me that I found when I first embarked on all of this research was that this is the only hospital in the state of Maryland, and quite possibly the only hospital in the history of the United States, that forced its own patients to build it from the ground up. And this is because doctors at the time had very particular beliefs about black people and their minds, their mental well-being. Many of them believed that emancipation was a mistake, and that black people weren't able to handle freedom, and that this rise in mental illness, in emotional disturbances that they were witnessing in the years after emancipation, they figured, well, it must be because they can't handle freedom. No one seemed to pause and ask, well, what effect might have enslavement had on black Americans? Mm-hmm. And so they create these segregated institutions from the very beginning with this idea that black people are different and therefore need to be treated differently, and that the solution, part of the therapy, the treatment, is to put them back to work. And so these patients in 1911 are brought into a forest, and they're not just carrying some water or sandbags and helping, you know, some contractors out. They are pouring cement, they are moving railways, they are building massive structures from the ground up, and they are working side by side through the day and night with contractors and electricians to build a hospital that, once it's complete, they're going to be marched inside and they're going to become its first patients. And so I often share that story with people so that they understand that this is really the beginning, the genesis of a story that comes to reflect so much of how black people are then treated. And the hospital's founding, it represents that moment after emancipation. It comes to represent fights over integration, civil rights, the fight for black people's complete and honest representation and participation in this country.
You document a number of horrific, quite frankly, accounts, acts of violence in Crownsville, abusive patients, inhumanity that really just takes your breath away. But there's also moments of real bravery and real humanity, in particular from some of the black staffers at the facility who really fight for people who aren't getting treatment. Does any one person or any one story stick with you?
Oh man, there are a few. There's this group, this clique of black women who arrive in the 1950s and 1960s, and they're some of the very first black people to get the opportunity to work at Crownsville. For its first several decades, it's a hospital that's all black patients and exclusively white employees. Then integration comes, and slowly more and more black local community members are able to get jobs and to treat people who don't just look like them, but in many cases went to school with them, rode the bus with them, lived down the street from them. They notice that many patients don't have clothes, so they go home and they gather their own leftover clothing and they bring it to the hospital. They notice that some of the male patients don't have belts and their pants are falling down all day and they're not able to live with dignity. So they go and they make their own makeshift belts. Very simple acts like that that for decades it seemed no other employee had thought to do. And so they start to transform the culture of the hospital just because they see those patients as human.
You dug into your own family history as part of your reporting as well, and the reluctance, as you mentioned, to talk about a lot of the mental health issues through the generations. You write this: in my family, the stories range from regular depression to anxiety to alcoholism and schizophrenia. We were warned about how much diabetes there was in our family medical history. It would have helped to know about the number of mental breakdowns, too. How has this changed how you look at the stigma surrounding mental health conversations, particularly around communities of color where there are fewer resources and these are often issues we just don't talk about?
It gave me more empathy because there was a time when I was very angry at some of my family members. I had tried to have conversations with them. I remember being in high school and asking my parents if I could have a therapist because I was feeling very down at school. And they said, no, that's not something that black people do. Therapists don't treat black people well. You can't trust them. And I felt like they'd shut me down and turned me away, and they were old school and they just didn't want to hear about my life and my experiences. But once you reckon with this history, when you see the way in which they were excluded from real therapy and mental health care treatment, or when they did access it, how harmful it at times could be, you start to understand why maybe did my grandparents and my parents think this system wasn't for them, that it wasn't safe for their children to engage in it.
The book is Madness, Race and Insanity in a Jim Crow Asylum. The author is Antonia Hilton. Antonia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When the Academy Award nominations were announced yesterday, among the films on the list for Best Picture was the year's biggest grossing movie, Barbie. But many were surprised the nominations for Best Director did not include the film's director, Greta Gerwig. Jeffrey Brown has a look for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
So how do these nominations get made, and why would both Greta Gerwig and the film's star, Margot Robbie, both be left off? Well, Washington Post chief film critic Anne Hornaday has been thinking and writing about this, and she joins me now. Hi, Anne. I mean, you wrote an interesting piece today in which you said that the range of films that were nominated in the Best Picture category really reflected the wonderful range of films being made, but not in the director's category. What happened there?
Well, Jeff, I think that let's focus on the good news, which is what an amazing year. I mean, I think that this is a wide range of films, both in theme, in tone, in approach, and it's just exactly what we want in scope. You know, we want the bigs, we want the littles, and we want the mediums. But the director's branch, when they nominate the five finalists for the Oscar, do tend to go with the kind of auteurist, you know, technically rigorous, ambitious work.
A lot of people pointing to an irony here that the director of a film smartly critiquing sexism in the culture, she doesn't get full recognition, and to some, that suggests that that very sexism is on display.
Well, I can understand that, but I'm not sure. I think we need to be really careful about, and maybe a little bit more thoughtful about framing this as pure sexism. I mean, let's not forget Justine Triet made the cut for Anatomy of a Fall. It might have as much to do, if not more, with genre than gender. You know, I mean, even though Poor Things made that cut for director, generally Oscars don't take comedies as seriously as art, you know, as dramas. And so I think that might have as much to do with it as anything. And it also, I think we need to kind of remind ourselves about how these nominations are made. You know, I mean, the nominations do come from the individual branches, and those members basically, you know, cast their ballots individually, anonymously, and confidentially. So it's not like they're getting in a room and making these decisions collectively. So I'm a little bit more hesitant to paint this with a wide brush of sexism or snub. I just think, you know, Frank, if anything, I think it points to just how rich the choices were. I mean, these are five, we can all quibble, and we would all sort of make our choice of who we would replace with whom, which is a really fun thing to do. And I think it increases our interest in movies. But at the end of the day, these are really, let's not forget, these are very strong choices and extremely well-directed films. So it's not as if somebody got in at somebody else's expense.
And then what about in the actress category where Margot Robbie did not get in? That was a very strong category of acting.
That's exactly right. That's my point exactly. I mean, and we don't know the numbers, you know, we don't know how close those votes were. So I just, even though I know it's heartbreaking for the people that don't, you know, that get up early and it's also, you know, something of a team sport, you know, for the fans of the movies, Barbie did get recognized in many other categories, including supporting actress, which was sort of a surprise to me, as well as Best Picture and other categories. So I don't know, maybe I'm being Pollyanna, but I do choose to see this as more good news than bad.
We have talked about this a lot in the past, about the lack of representation in films and then lack of representation in the awards and the nominations. There have been many changes made in the makeup of the Academy itself. Do you see the results of that in recent years?
If anything, I see the results in the increase in international membership. I think that's where we're really seeing sea changes. And I think it's terribly exciting. And I think it returns cinema to its proper global place. You know, even though Oscars are quintessentially Hollywood, the transmission between Hollywood and other countries and other cultures is longstanding and rich. And so I think the degree to which we're seeing things like Parasite and Michelle Yeoh winning for Everything Everywhere All at Once, and this year Anatomy of a Fall, I just think it suggests a widening of the lens when it comes to what we consider movies and mainstream movies, and that's all to the good.
Anne Hornaday of The Washington Post, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.